Good evening, everyone. My name is Don C. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Don C. Love you, Don C. Lots and lots and lots. Oh, my God.
I assume you're aware when you do that, you can actually feel that energy just goes. Can you feel that up? It's like, what is that? That's the love. That's what that is. You guys just blow my mind because I think you're an example of what sobriety should be. It should be fun. It should be happy. It should be together. I attended one of these in San Francisco last year. And, you know, it kind of changed my life. I'm going to try that before I'm done tonight, but that's just wonderful. I am from the Mohican Nation, and our tribe is a clan system, so I was born for the Turtle Clan on my mother's side, and my Indian name is Tatanka Wambli. That name was given to me by the elders when I was given the responsibility to be the keeper of this hoop of 100 eagle feathers. If you want to see more about that, if you look at our website, whitebison.org, you'll see the story of the hoop of 100 eagle feathers. I have 9 children. I have 6 girls. And all my kids are now sober. Three of them, they were a part of you when I was still drinking, and I thank you for giving them the help that they needed when I wasn't able to at that time. And so I just have a lot of respect for this organization. To see it spread in, you know, so much, it's very, very wonderful to see that young people in sobriety, there's just nothing like it. I have 17 grandchildren, and number 18's on the way, and all my grandchildren are sober. And, and our family, we had to go through a lot of work. It's like what you said, it wasn't... It actually got worse when I quit drinking. They weren't all that happy about that right away. But through a lot of talking circles and eventually using our medicines and using the sweat lodges and the prayers and Al-Anon and Alateen and all of those, I believe, have broken that cycle of dysfunction that we have. It's not that we don't fight. We know how to fight. We know how to make up and those things. So it's very, very nice now to have the families and come together, you know, like that. And probably I'm so moved that this is on Indian land. I never thought I would see this. I never thought I would see this type of event held in Indian country. But I thank you for this type of outreach. There's a lot of places that you could have went, but you came here to us, and we need it. I think tomorrow you'll see a lot more. We'll be here, I think, on Saturday is my experience. So thank you for bringing it here. I flew in today, and I had lunch with a couple of the tribal people, and they were like in awe that you're here, and they've put a lot of support out for. I think you'll see more of the young people coming tomorrow, but they were just almost tearful that this was actually here on their land. I don't know if you know the history of this tribe, but sometime look it up on Google. They have a very hard time at certain times in the past, and they've come a long way, and they've done some wonderful things for their community, and they're working on sobriety and recovery, you know, just like all the tribes are. But I think maybe because it is on Inland, I want to tell you a story that kind of meant a lot to me when I heard it, and it's a story about the eagles that was raised by chickens. And there was this farm, this guy had this farm, and he was out working in the yard, and he heard a gunshot just a little ways from his house, so he says, "Who's shooting that on my land?" So he walked over there, and he got by this tree, and he looked down there, and there was two eagles, both dead. Somebody shot them both, and they laid there, and he was upset about that. He said, why would somebody shoot these eagles? And as he's pondering, he thought he heard this noise, and he looked up, and there was a nest up there. And he got thinking. He said, "I wonder if there's any little eagles in there." And so he finally said, "I got to go find out." So he climbed up that tree, and as soon as he got up there, he looked in the nest, and there were these two little eagles was in there. And he says, "Oh my God, what am I going to do?" He said, "Their parents are dead. Got to do something." So he took them both and he stuck them in his pocket. He climbed down the tree and he's going back by the farm and he's trying to figure out, "What am I going to do? I don't know anything about raising these eagles." And as he walked past the chicken coop, he got this idea. He says, "I wonder what would happen if I just put them in with the chickens." So he took them out of his pocket and he put them in there, and the chickens accepted them right away. So he watched it for a couple days, and then everything was okay, so he wasn't worried no more. So as a little time went on, these two little eagles, they grew some, and their feathers changed a little bit. And finally, one of the little eagles said to the other, he said, "Bro," he said, "something's not right here." He said, "We're not like these chickens here." And the other one says, "Look, just cool it." He says, "We got food. Just do whatever they do." And so he said, "Okay." But then they grew up and they changed a little bit more. And so this one, he kept thinking, he said to his brother, he said, "You know, there's something really, really wrong here." He said, they're crowing, and when we try to crow, we don't even sound like them, and they're scratching and we fall over when we try to, something's really wrong. Well, they had gotten to the point where they were at this age of hormones, so this one of them was very interested in the chickens, and he was doing quite well with them. So he didn't want the story changed at all. So he said, "Just cool it, you know." So he did. So spring came by, and the farmer, he decided, "You know, I'm going to open up the yard, and I'm going to let them all go out there and get fresh worms and bugs and all this stuff." So he opened up the deal, and they all went out. And so one of these eagles, he walked on his path, is kind of exploring, and he's looking all around, and finally he heard this laughter. And he was looking all around to see where this laughter was coming from, and finally he looked up in a tree, and there's this owl up there. And this owl is bent over just laughing. He said, "What are you laughing at?" He said, "I'm laughing at you." He said, "You're an eagle, and you're acting like a chicken. I've never seen anything so funny." "I am a chicken." He says, "Oh, crow for me." And the eagle tried it, and the owl just busted up. He said, "That is so weird." So he started to talk to this eagle, and he said, "You know something?" He said, "You're an eagle. You're not a chicken." And he said, "The Creator made you very, very special. That you fly the high, way up in the sky, higher than any animals. And all the Indians, they believe that you carry their prayers. And if they can get an eagle feather, it's like gold to them. They honor that." And he said, "Well, I don't know. I'm just an old chicken." And he said, "You fly way, way up high." And he couldn't convince him. So finally the owl, he said to the eagle, he said, "I want you to get on my back and hang on." So he hopped up on Owl's back, and of course it's kind of heavy, so Owl had to run a little bit. But finally he got enough speed, got his wings out, and he's flying. He's going higher, higher, and this eagle is hanging on, and he's looking over, and he didn't know he had fear of height. He's just shaking, and his eyes are closed, and he says, "Take me back. No, 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 I got to show you." And he kept cycling up, cycling. Finally got way, way high, and then leveled off, and he told that eagle, he said, "Open your eye." And he opened up his eye, and he couldn't believe how high he was, and he was just scared. He was just screaming, "Take me back home, take me back. I want to go back to the coop." "No, no, the Creator made you special. You carry the prayers. You're supposed to." And there was no listening going on there. So finally, the owl, he started swerving like in a circle, back and forth like this. And finally, he made it, and he flipped over upside down and knocked that eagle off. And the eagle goes tumbling through the air, and it's just tumbling. And so this owl is folded its wings, and it's driving right alongside of that eagle that's falling, and he's going, "Spread your wings, spread your wings." "Oh no, I can't, it hurts." "No, you gotta spread them, spread them." It's like a sponsor, right? And so finally he tries it a little bit, and it goes off to the side, and the ground is coming up, and the sponsor is talking, but this is like life and death stuff here, you know. "Spread your wings, you gotta do it." And finally he put his wings out far enough, and the air just flipped him out, and he started to fly. And something happened to that eagle. Something like a memory come back from him, and he said, "I knew I wasn't a chicken. I knew it." And all of a sudden, it's like his memory come back, and he said, "You know, if I spread my feathers on my tail," he says, I think I can, he spread them back and flapped his wings, just red, flying in the same place. He started to remember what he could do, and then pretty soon he's doing hoops. He just couldn't believe it. Well, he's so excited, he wanted to get back to the coop and tell his brother. So they got back there and looked for his brother. Here's his brother leaning up against the wall, and there's a hen there, and that eagle, he's telling her the words, you know, speaking the music. "Brother, brother, you gotta come with me and see this owl, because we're not chicken. Just next week, all right? I got this thing going, been working on it," and he had no interest. And finally, the chicken got upset and took off on him. So he convinced them then to go on out. They got down to see the owl. The owl was telling him, too, "Oh, you're an eagle, you know, and you were made by the Creator, and the feathers, and everybody wants one." And he just wanted to get back. But to appease everyone, he hopped on the owl's back. He got on there. Took off. He too was scared. "Take me back, take me back." And he got all the way up and leveled off, and is telling him about the Creator and how the Creator made him, and is special, and he carries the prayers and about the feathers and all that. And finally, he just wanted to go back. So the owl, he does the same deal. Flips him up, and he goes, starts falling. He comes right alongside of him. "Spread your wings, spread your wings." "No, I can't, it hurts." "I know it hurts. That's where inventory is, but you got to do it, you know." And so anyway, because it's a life and death matter. And as he got near the ground, this one was a little more stubborn, but that owl is screaming, "Spread your wings." Finally, he did, and out his wing, and he started to fly too. And kind of the moral of that story is many of us, we were raised by chickens. We were raised in violent families. I was raised in a domestic violent family. I watched my mother get beat up and get kicked. I was sexually abused by an uncle. I had that experience. And during that time, I was told a lot of times, "You're a piece of crap and you're no good," and the fighting and the bullying and all that was going on, and I grew up And then I run into that friend alcohol, and that alcohol helped with a lot of that because it helped me to, you see, to not go there. But it wasn't until I came to you that is where I learned how to fly. I didn't know what an Indian was. I didn't know what a man was no more. I didn't know. I was just trying to make it. I was trying to. I had told so many lies and things, you know, that I was just in serious trouble financially, all kinds of trouble, as some of you know. So it's sort of like this. There's some things I have learned that I'm quite certain about in my recovery. I know there is a creator. I have no doubt about that. I know I have this disease of alcoholism. I know that. I don't doubt that at all. I know I have that. I know that what they told me is that if I did what was in this book in 164 pages, if I did this, what they told me was I would never have to drink again. And that was, I tried everything I knew about to quit drinking. I couldn't do it. And when I heard somebody say that there was a possible thing that I could do, and it was in these pages, if I followed those instructions, they said, you'll never have to drink again. My last drink was August 10th, 1978, 34 years ago. So the other thing that I know is that many of us, whatever our situations that we were in, we were told a lot of things. We probably did a lot of things. I did a lot of things. And that there's a lot of people telling us, judging, and saying all sorts of things about us. But if you have anybody telling you something other than that, how beautiful you are, how smart you are, how spiritual you are, if they are telling you anything other than that, what you take away from here tonight is that's just chicken shit. That's what that is. That's not true. So I want to tell you about the man who led me through this work and taught me how to fly. And it was one of these spread your wings. I don't want to. Mine was, I couldn't believe when I come in here that I had to ask a white guy to help me. I was pretty prejudiced when I come in here. I remember the very first AA meeting I went to. I knew that I had to have this help. I had heard about AA. And I didn't tell nobody I was going, so I went down to this, found a meeting in the afternoon. I went there. And it was on Colorado Springs, Tejon Street. And it was one of those places where you park diagonal. And so I went down there, and there was a place right in front of the doorway to the meeting hall. And so I drove by there, and I said, I'm going to go around the block. And if I come around that block and that spot still is empty, that's a sign I'm supposed to go in that meeting. So I come around there, and that spot was still there. And I thought to myself, I said, okay, I'm going to go around one more time. And if it, then it really, I'm really, really supposed to go in there. So I drove about as slow as my old res car would go, going around that block. And I come there, and that spot was still empty. So I went in there. And I got in there, and that particular meeting had what they call a greeter. Because I peeked in that room. And my first thought was, I says, oh my God, these are all white people. And so I was going to leave, but I bump into this greeter, big old guy, and a coffee in my hand, and before I knew it, I was sitting down. So when the meeting started, and they say, my name's so-and-so, you know, I said, I ain't telling them nothing. I ain't saying shit to these people. They have none of their business. So when it come to me, I didn't say nothing. I just give me a little moment of silence, and they just kept on going. But I come out of that meeting, and there were three things that I remember about it. One was, I couldn't believe they were talking about themselves like they were. You know, I'm selfish, and I'm selfish. Where I come from, you didn't say shit like that. That's a pretty sign of weakness, so you never talk like that. And here they were talking like that out loud. And the other thing I couldn't stand was the laughter. They was laughing, just cracking up about things, and there was nothing funny that I could see from my point of view. The third thing that I remember from that meeting is there was a feeling there. And I didn't know what that feeling was. I'd never felt that before. That's that thing you threw up here. That's the one I'm talking about. That's that feeling I felt in that group of people. And I wanted to come back and experience that again. Because I was prejudiced against them and all those thoughts I had. All they wanted to do was help me with my alcoholism. They didn't care whether I was Indian or not. They weren't interested in none of that. They just wanted to help me get sober and tell me how they did it. It was me that had the problem, you see, not them. So I got this, I selected this man to help me. I asked him to help. I watched him. And he was a white guy too. But there was something about him that attracted my eye. He was like an elder that needed some polishing. But there was something about him, so I asked him if he would be my sponsor. And he said, well, we'll talk about it. So we sat there, and he was 6'6", and he was an attorney. And he was a real alcoholic. He was in a lot of bar fights, so he was beat up, quite scarred up. He was hit with an ugly stick when he was a little bitty baby. That's how I best like it. Described, that man's ugly. And so I'm asking him to be my sponsor. Here he's sizing me up, you know, like looking me up and down like this. And then he said, I don't know, you know, he says, I've been around these rooms for over 15 years. And he says, I watch you Indians, you come and go. He says, you always sit way in the back, that back row, that's where the Indians all sit. And when it comes time or anybody calls on you, I pass. He said, you all passed. He said, I saw one of you guys stay here 6 months one time. He said, but most of you guys don't make it. He said, I don't know why it is. You guys are just so weird. And he was talking that way, and he was just really making me upset, the way he was looking down at me, you know, like this. And I can remember I was looking at him right in the eye, and he was, I don't know if you've ever had this experience, like when you were a kid, you're parents got you a little puppy, and then you tease it, you know, you like rub its face or something until it starts to growl, and you know, you just keep on. That's what I felt he was doing. He was like, you guys don't make it, and you Indians sit way in the back. And I thought to myself, I'll show you, you white son of a bitch, I'm gonna make it. I'll show you. But what was really behind that, I found out later on, was I didn't care. And the only thing that he could really pick up on that he had to work with was my anger. And so he just kept me pissed off about things. Very kind. So he showed me this book. And he also selected the meetings I was to go to. I didn't get a chance to choose. On Monday night, it was this group, and the big book study group, and then there was this discussion group, and this other group. And so 6 nights of the week, he picked the meetings I was to go to. Sunday night was my meeting of choice. And I was to go to these meetings, and I was to say, my name is Don, I'm an alcoholic. And he said, then shut up. Don't talk no more until after you take a third step. Because he says, you have nothing of any value to share. So just don't say anything. And so, of course, you know, the community, they kind of, it's kind of a small community. Everybody knows who's your sponsor. They go, ooh, he can't talk, you know. And so I remember one of the meetings, Wednesday night meeting I was to go to was in a place called Eagle Lodge. And I went there, and would you know, I was sitting there drinking coffee before the meeting started, and this Indian gal walked in. And I swear to God, she was looking at me in that way. Yeah. What we call it is snagging. So how the words that we use. I think she was giving that snagging look. And I sat there and I was a little bit nervous, and I thought, I'm not going to impress this person if I just say my name's Don, I'm an alcoholic. I got to say something more, you know, here. And so it come time for me to speak, and so I started doing it, 449. And I would quote that big book, you know, and on page 86. And man, her smile got so big, I knew I was going to have coffee. There was no doubt in my mind. And so we did. We went to have some coffee and stuff. But I was so in the zone, or whatever you call it. I felt like John Travolta, you know, in a movie when he's walking down the street. After I was walking home, you know, I was just... And I walked in, and I give her my phone number on a matchbook cover, and I walked in my apartment, and the phone was ringing. And my thought was, she wants me, I can tell. She can't wait. And so I pick up the phone, I give it one of these, hello. And who was it? My sponsor. They're like the internet. He's like, what in the hell were you doing talking tonight? You know, they always find out, you see what you're doing. But I used to look at this book, and they talked about the instructions that was in it, and I could never see those darn instructions anywhere. I could not find them. But then, when I had this owl, this sponsor helping me, before you spread your wings, this is why riding on his back, he'd say, the first 44 pages has to do with the first half of step one. And in my case, he said, you need to read it 25 times. So I had to, you know, you do like four little marks and then so I had to read it that many times because he said, you're, what's in there? There's not that much to work with, you know, and that focuses. And I remember one time, I worked with a man named Johnny Looking Cloud, too. He was one of my sponsors and a Lakota guy. And I had this big thing happen one day, and I went to Johnny Looking Cloud, and I wanted some advice because I wanted to just go kick somebody's rear, not pray for him. So I was in that mode. And so I went there, and his using this knowledge, you know, that I didn't want to hear, like, take it one day at a time, and... You know, when you're that upset, that's the last thing you want to do. Take it. You just want to go kick his rear. That's what you want to do. And so I walk out the door, and he called me back, and he gave me an eagle feather. He said, I want you to have this feather. You're supposed to have it. And he said, when you get like this feeling, he said, I want you to go grab this feather to pray with it. He said, because your head is like an inner ghetto. He said, every time you go in there, you mug yourself. He said, don't go in there alone. It's really dangerous for you. Take this feather with you. And so that was the type of sponsorship, you know, that I had. So then I had to look at this second part of step one called unmanageability. And he showed me there was 9 areas that I was to look at. Because the instructions for that was on page 52 of this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a paragraph in there, and it says something like, we were having problems with our personal relationships. So I had to take that, flip it into a sentence, question, and then I had to take a look at it. Am I having problems with my personal relationships? We were full of fear, so I had to flip it into and what I was able to see for the first time in my life, a way on how I was to look at myself, and I could see for the first time, I never got along with no one. I was hustling. That's what I was doing. If I did you a favor, there was something coming back. And so I took that work to him on those nine areas, and then he said, these steps are all interconnected with each other. They're not separate, but they're in a natural order that you've got to do one. Then from one, that gives you information that you need for step two. You can't miss it. And so it was there that he showed me this came to believe that a power. And I took those nine areas of unmanageability, and he showed me how to create nine visions in step two. So what would a relationship look like if the Creator was involved in it? And so I created these nine visions, and what he told me was, because the steps are all connected, interconnected, is he says, that step two sets your intent for step 11 and 12. That creates the direction in which you start to move. It happens clear into step two. And so I created that. And then I had some problems with step three. One of the reasons, I think, was on our reservation, there was a church there, one church at that time, and they always doing mission work. The churches do. And so they always offered food and clothes, but you always had to hear the sermon first. And then you got the food and the clothes. So our parents made us all go there, right? And you had to listen to the pitch. And they each had their own way. So some of you had to learn, and you had to make this kind of a ceremony motions, you know. And they would do that, and then they'd run out of money, and zip, they were gone. And then the Catholics would come in, and they'd find out that those other guys were there, and they'd say, "Oh, you're lucky we come along, because that all those people are going to hell." And you went, "Phew, man, I'm glad that you know I didn't get too involved in it and whatever." And then, of course, it was like the Catholics come along, and you know, to a little Indian kid, a nun in how they used to dress is pretty scary. You know, they have those they got rulers up there, and they patrol, and you know, I'm just like recalling how I felt it was when I was a little kid, and like they'd say, "You ever been burned with a cigarette?" "Uh-huh." "Well, you see, when you go to hell, your whole body is going to be feeling like that. Blisters all over your body. Don't you want to see God?" "You bet I do, sister. I want to see God, see?" And she'd say, "You ever been thirsty?" "Yeah, I've been thirsty." "Well, there ain't no water in hell. So your body is going to be blistering." And well, I ended up with a concept of God, you know. It was like you had the flames of hell licking your ass to see God, and that's why you did it. It was scary. And so, of course, when I got off the res and on my own, you know, I couldn't do that anymore. Then I come in here to you, and what you guys are saying on that third step, "Well, now you got to turn your life over to God." And I'm going, "I don't think so, you know. I don't know if I can do that." But it was sort of like, thank God for whoever's wisdom it was, is it said, "God, as you understand it." And so the way that my sponsor had me work was whatever step I was on, no matter what meeting I went to, I was to focus on information flow for that step. So step three, he used to say, "That's the only problem you got in your whole life, step three. You got no other problems." "Yeah, but I'm not paying my bills." I know. "The only problem you got, step three, step you're on." So I'm still riding on his back, you know. And so I was in this meeting one time, and there was a guy from California in there. And he was talking about step three. And he told this story about, he said, there's this pond, and there's a log in there. And on that log, there's four frogs are sitting on there. And he said, one of those frogs made a decision to jump in the water. He said, "How many frogs are left?" "Yeah." "Well," I said, "three." He said, "No." "Well," he said, "this is the way the third step works. When that frog makes a decision to turn his life over to the care of God, God makes that frog orange." So you got three green ones and one frog to turn his life over. Now nothing's happened except he's turned green. So I used to get confused in AA because you'd hear this about the will. Well, I turned it over and I took it back and I took it back and I turned it over in the afternoon and I turned it over and I took it back and I took it. I go, how the hell do you, this is really puzzling to me, you know, turning it over back and forth all the time. And but what he said was, he said, once you become an orange frog, he said, say on Wednesday, so let's say Thursday you get all pissed off about something. He said, all you are is just a pissed off orange frog. Well, what happens if you go get drunk on Sunday? He said, you're a drunk orange frog. Once, and somehow, wherever my little ghetto mind was, I got what the third step was about. I was just to become an orange frog. So I go over to my sponsor, right, and in my excitement, you know, I say, oh, I'm ready to become an orange frog. And you just, you know, he panics sometimes on the process of the steps. So I went over there with him, and we took that third step out of the book. Me and that old man, he opened it up and got on our knees, and he held it, and he read that third step prayer, and then I read it. So then I asked him what next, and before I left her, I was writing inventory. He showed me how to write a 5-column resentment inventory, how to write a 4-column fear inventory, and 11-column sex inventory. 11 columns, meaning he felt it was better to look at just the dishonesty by itself, just the suspicion by itself, to see what the pattern was. And so he was very, very clear in writing this inventory that I was to leave nothing out. Sexual stuff, things that happened, things that I did, everything had to be in there. And it's very, very clear that if I left something out, I would set myself up for a drink. I had to tell it all. And so I did. I wrote this inventory. And when it was done, I knew it was good. I knew that was a good inventory. But what I did, different than the instruction, was I had 2 little notebooks. On one of them, I wrote all the sick shit. And the other stuff, I just wrote the normal resentment, fear, and sex. And so, when I had to go fifth step it, I call him up, and that afternoon, I remember it was a Friday afternoon, and I knew that night I had to fifth step or I was going to drink. It was one or the other, because I was setting on that inventory, because I didn't want to tell nobody what was in there. I didn't want anybody to know that part. Because I could put on the mask, I could do the hustle and change subjects. And how are you doing? Fine, how are you doing? And I could divert, you know, all of those types of things. So I call him up, and they take him to the hospital. I called another guy, he didn't answer. I called a third guy. You know, it's kind of hard to have a stranger be the recipient of admitting to yourself, to God, and to another human being, what was in there. And so I went there and I did that. And when it was done, he said, is that it? And I said, that's not that bad. And he said, I'm going to make another pot of coffee. So then he started telling me some of the stuff was in his inventory. And that guy was sicker than me. I mean, he was not well. And so all of a sudden, I said, you know, I do have a couple more pieces of paper I just remembered. And so I bought out the other stuff, and but he knew what was going on. He knew what the hustle was. And so I struggled with reading some of that. And he would just put his hand on my shoulder, and he'd say, just read another one. Just do it. Do another line. Do another word. Just encouraging me. And so I did that. And I made it through there. And then, according to instructions, I was to go home and do a review. And there were some questions I was to ask. He stayed on standby in case I had missed something and it came up. And then what I found out from them was that every odd step has a set of promises. Every set of promises has a condition. Withholding nothing, then you get a cookie or But you withhold something, you don't get the cookie. That's the way, just the way that it is. So when it says you got to tell it all, you got to tell it all. And so he said, when it's done, he said, I want you to then claim the promises, the fifth step promises. You can look the world in the eye. You can look at it. First time in my life, I started to cry. Something went on, just sitting in that old apartment where I was at. Something started to go on, and I experienced a freedom that I had never known before. The story of the sexual abuse, I can tell that story. I didn't forget it. It wasn't removed. But I can tell that story if I want, when I'm working with someone, or if there is a reason or a purpose to do it. And I'm not imprisoned by that sexual abuse that can happen, because I can fly now. I got to wings. I didn't have those wings before. And for me, it was the going through that inventory process and the fifth step process, going through that. That was when it's like that tumbling, I can't do it. Spread your wings. I can't. But went on and finally, you know, was able to make it. Then started to remember some things. Things that my grandpa told me. My grandpa wasn't a negative person when I was a little kid. And I started to remember the ceremonies. And I started to remember songs. The things that happened when I was really, really small. I started to remember the medicines, how to pick the medicines, you know, on the reservation. It was like, you know, I started to see for the first time I wasn't what all those people had told me all that time. It's like the third column in inventory. When you write that third column in inventory, you are not writing the truth about you. You are writing the truth about the lie. That's what's coming out in the third column of the inventory. That's not the truth. It's about the lie. And so I got through that work, and I had a lot of amends to make. He was very insistent. I make my amends wherever possible in person. And I had to write them out, because the second amend that I made, I changed the story because it got kind of rough, so I kind of minimized what I originally was going to say. So my sponsor caught that, so he made me write it out, and he had to approve it. And then I had to go there and read that. And I had to make amends for making amends one time. And those are really humbling, to go back and you know, and make that. But it's just like that set of promises that came out in the ninth step. Those promises started to come true for me. And so I did 10 and 11. Now, I was sponsored to do the work every year. That's how I was taught. Not everybody does, and I have no opinions on which way of those are good, bad, or whatever. It works for me to do them every year. And so usually the month of July is when I go through and I do that work. And then I got to, I lived AA. When I saw that it was available to me too, because I wasn't so sure, even though you told me it was. It wasn't until I found what you told me was true. And then I remember when I got a little over 3 years sober, something went wrong for me. And I go to meetings, and meetings sucked, and my sponsor was stupid. I couldn't write no more in a big book. I had underlined, quoted, defined, looked things up. And it wasn't making any more sense. And it was like, I'd sat in meetings, and it was like, you're talking way too long, and what you said it three times already. Why don't you say it just one time and shut up? You don't need to. And then I go to the next one, you know, and that's where I was, and I felt I was going insane. So my kids were saying, Dad, you need a meeting, you know, stuff like that. And I didn't know what was wrong. And I was getting scared. So I went up to see Johnny Looking Cloud, and I talked to him about it. And what he said was, He said, how long are you sober exactly? And I told him, exactly. He says, oh, now I understand. He says, you're right where you're supposed to be. Now, when you're in a bag of shit like that, you don't want somebody telling you you're right where you're supposed to be, you know. Or God doesn't give you more than you can handle. To hell he don't, because that's why you go nuts, you know. Or take it one day at a time, you know. You take it one day at a time. But he said, it's now time that you bring the culture into the 12 steps. He says, the 12 steps, it helps you to be in harmony with the earth and with all the beings and with all the relatives. And there's circles and there's seasons and there's cycles, and you've got to work with that. Be in harmony with all of those things. And he said, the human being, it travels in a 4-year cycle. Your first year of sobriety is like a spring. Second year is like a summer. Third is like a fall. Fourth is like a winter. And so he says, you come into the program, and just like the sap flows in the tree, you come in there, and the spirit of the group, it starts to flow in you. You don't know it, but the other people see it. They'll even tell you, you're kind of glowing, they'll say. But they recognize that spirit is of the, like a sap in a tree. And he says, in that first year, you do the work and you start to see these little buds all over on the branches. Now, you don't know, have any idea what the heck is going on. Sponsors do. Other people do, because they've been budding, but you may not. But they're telling you about those buds. And it's like you were saying, they see that bud, just do what they say. Because they know you're budding. You don't know. You talk yourself out of success. Then it comes the next season and everything unfolds. And it's that second year you've got to shape. You start to now know this is who I am. I'm an alcoholic. You know your boundaries. You start to set. Then you'll come, the third year is like winter time or fall time. Now fall time sobriety, it's not that things don't go wrong. It's but you get a flat tire still, but you get it right by the gas station. Yes, see? So it's like you're in the groove. And just like the oak tree, if you could imagine, it's standing out there and it's got these leaves and foliage and red and yellow, and people are taking these pictures and you would want to stay like this forever, then all of a sudden the cycle comes along. The temperature changes a little bit, gust of wind comes along, and the leaves start to fall. And at first the oak tree just says, that's no problem, I got a lot of leaves. And then it continues and loses them all. So about half of them go away. Now oak tree is coming to meetings and it's trying to be really positive, saying, you know, well, I still, but inside that oak tree is thinking to itself, shit. Because it knows the rest is going away. And what he said is, those leaves, they're all your beliefs and those things that you learn. And eventually, there's things beyond what you first learned. So you got to unbelieve themselves. So a lot of those leaves, those beliefs you have, they have no power no more. That's why they don't work. So it seems like nothing's going on. Just like how nature takes the leaves away, the cycle takes your beliefs, what you thought to be true at one time. And so he says, but spring is next. And so I learned in sobriety to travel in a 4-year cycle, a 4-year season. A lot of people slip 3 to 4, 7 to 8, 11 to 12, 15 to 16. Just watch it, you'll just see the cycle works. So I remember I was left there and I was crying. The reason I was crying was I thought God was mad at me. I thought, because I said shit out loud in public, that my sobriety was taken away. I thought I was doing something wrong in the work. I wasn't doing nothing wrong. I was right exactly where I was supposed to be. And so I've traveled that path of the cycles, and now I started to bring in the culture. So now when I work the steps, the third step I take with the pipe, and I light my sage and I write inventory with burning the medicine and the cedar and the sweetgrass. I fifth step in a sweat lodge. Then I take my character defects and I make a tobacco tie for each of the character defects. Then I go back in the sweat lodge and I offer that tobacco tie to the grandfathers, to the hot rocks, one at a time, to please take this away. So I've learned to do that. I had to make apologies to the animals. I quit hunting. I'm a good hunter. I only do that if I'm hungry or I need to feed my family. I don't do it for sport. I had to make apologies to the earth, dumping things on the ground, throwing garbage out. I had to make amends because those are all our relatives. That's what they are. And so I've learned to soar. That's how my sponsor taught me to spread my wings. I had to come to you. I really got a true understanding of the culture after I was in AA. I didn't understand my own culture before. I understood the power, understood the God that you have. It's not the God like I had. I would say one of the blessings that I have in this program is if I would be able to share with you the relationship that I have with the Creator. It is so cool. It's so beautiful. It's so wonderful. So I guess if I were to close this way, and I would say, if I had to pick the best thing that happened in my sobriety, it would be the relationship I have with the Creator. That is the best. If I had to pick the worst thing that happened to me in my drinking time, I would say it was the loneliness. You know that hole? And you can't fill it? And you do a lot of stuff just to see if it will fill. And it won't. And it didn't, because what was missing, it wasn't found in relationships. It wasn't found. It was God was missing in my life. That's what was missing, you know, in mine. So I'll close with this prayer. It seems like everything I know is of any value I got from you guys. That's how it seems. And this prayer says, God, thank you for what you've given me. And it says, God, thank you for what you've taken from me. And God, thank you for what you've left me. That feeling that I talked about, I didn't know what it was till later on, but that's how it feels to belong to a tribe. That's what that feeling is. That thing when you go there to that circle, you belong. And I sometimes tell a story that if God come down and said, here's the choices you got. You can either belong to your tribe or you can belong to AA, but you got to lose one of them. If it came down to that. When I was drinking, my relatives, when I was back on the reservation, there was this one time I was doing some naughty things up there, and they took me to the border down by the bus, and they said, don't you ever come back here. We don't want you here. Some years later, I came to you, did similar things, and maybe worse than what you said was keep coming back. That's what you guys said, keep coming back. Thank you very much.
Hallowed be. tempted.